to Blue Dot, a look at our place in space. I'm Dave Schlom. The planet Mars has been a major target for exploration for nearly half a century. From the Viking landers in 1976 to Mars Pathfinder in 1997, which was made famous in pop culture in the movie The Martian, to the twin rovers Spirit and Opportunity that explored the surface of the red planet starting in 2004 and ended due to exhausted power long after their planned mission life of a few months. Spirit lasted for 6 years, and Opportunity made it for over 14, memorably ending its communications with NASA's JPL scientists in 2019. Since 2012, the Mars Science Laboratory rover, better known as Curiosity, has been exploring Gale Crater, and this year, the yet-to-be-named Mars 2020 rover will be launched from Cape Canaveral in Florida in July for an exploration of Jezero Crater after hopefully landing in February of 2021. In this episode, we'll talk to two deputy project scientists for both Curiosity and the Mars 2020 rover to explore in-depth how these two rovers are and will continue reshaping our understanding of our planetary neighbor. While we don't yet know whether or not Mars has ever had any form of life on it, we are closing in on a possible answer. Joining us later to talk about the new rover mission to Mars will be Ken Williford from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. But first, let's find out what we've learned about Gale Crater's environment with Curiosity rover deputy project scientist Abigail Freeman. She joins us from JPL in Pasadena. Abby, welcome to Blue Dot.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
I'd like to start by asking you to kind of give us a big picture here. Now, Curiosity has been roving around Gale Crater on Mars since 2012, right?
Yes, that's right. We landed on the floor of Gale Crater way back in 2012. And since that time, we have been climbing a mountain that's in the middle of the crater. The mountain is named Mount Sharp. And so it took us a couple years to get to the base of the mountain. And then we've been climbing ever since. We've climbed, 350 meters almost.
For our listeners who may not be familiar, give us a sense of, it's not like Curiosity is jamming around. Give us a sense of how long it takes to get from here to there.
Certainly, yeah. So the rover itself, in terms of how far we can drive, we're limited in terms of the fact that there's a lot of science we want to do along the way. We're not just going drive, drive, drive. Sometimes we're limited too in how fast we can drive because we can't drive the rover real time. Mars is so far away that it takes our commands 10, 20 minutes to get there. So, say if we were driving the rover real time, we sent a command. By the time we got information where the rover was, it would be 20, 40 minutes later. So we have a lot of autonomy, which takes time. It's slower to drive when you're autonomous. And then we're limited by the amount of power we have every day. So typically in a good day when we want to do a really long drive, we can go 60, 80 meters per day. Over the course of the last 7 years, we've gone something like 21 kilometers.
Yeah, well, and that's quite an exploration. I just want our listeners to know that, it does take a while to get from here to there for the rover. I'd like to ask you, now that you've been exploring Mars, and you've been personally involved in exploring Mars for a while now, because you were a science team member with the other rover, Spirit and Opportunity, right?
Yes. So my involvement in Mars goes way back to when I was actually in high school and had a small kind of outreach role with Spirit and Opportunity and was totally inspired and thought this was the coolest thing ever. And so have been kind of in and out since then. I went to school, I got a degree, I got my PhD. And then I was the deputy project scientist for Spirit and Opportunity for several years until the end of that mission. And then I've also been on the science team for Curiosity since we landed back in 2012.
Yeah, and now you're the deputy project scientist, right?
That's right. So I was recently appointed deputy project scientist for Curiosity.
And what does that mean? What are your responsibilities as the deputy project scientist?
So I really help coordinate kind of at a very high level activities among the science team, thinking about how as this team of over 400 people, we can work together to make a plan for one vehicle on the surface of Mars, and then also providing an interface with the engineers who operate the rover here at JPL and the science team, making sure that this whole huge team of hundreds and hundreds of people can work together, really with a specific bent on my end to achieve the science that we really want to achieve.
Well, and with the two previous rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, their goal was to kind of the follow the water mission to try to find evidence for water on Mars in the past, and they did spectacularly. What I'd like to know from you is, you know, it must be very difficult to figure out we're going to send this, you know, incredible machine, Curiosity rover, to Mars, and you have to pick a site. You know, you have to pick a place on this huge planet, one spot to go explore, and Gale Crater was the place you decided to explore. I'd like you to start out by giving us an overview on, tell us about Gale Crater in general, and then I'll ask you some follow-up questions, but tell us what Gale Crater is like and why it was chosen.
Sure. So in thinking about why we chose Gale Crater, it's important to think about the goal of Curiosity. So the first rovers that we put on Mars, as you said, their primary objective was to follow the water. At that time, we didn't have any evidence that there had been any liquid water on the surface of Mars. Both of those rovers found definitive evidence that there was. And this is exciting because we know liquid water is one of kind of three big ingredients for life. So with Curiosity, we wanted to advance that, and we wanted to ask a bigger question. Okay, there was water, but was this a habitable environment? Was there a place on Mars that had all three ingredients that life needed? And so that's liquid water, but that's also things like a source of carbon and a source of energy that life could have used. So in considering this as our mission goal and the instruments on the rover that can measure these things, we decided Gale Crater was a spectacular landing site. One of the main features of Gale Crater and the reason it was chosen was, as I alluded earlier, it's filled with this giant mountain. There's a big mountain right in the middle of this impact crater. And this mountain, it's about 3 miles high. So that's about, you know, the depth of the Grand Canyon. And we could see from orbit that the layers in this mountain, the mountain itself was layered. We could see the layers from orbit. And not only could we see that the mountain was layered, we could see that there were certain minerals in these layers that only form in water. And we could see all of these channels kind of leading into the crater from the rim. So we had sort of hoped before we landed that maybe this represented a site that was once an ancient lake that had liquid water, but importantly had liquid water that was around for a long time and would maybe be a great place to look for the other ingredients that make a habitable environment.
So Abby, now that we've been exploring Gale Crater for these years, what do we know about this environment and its past that we didn't know before Curiosity, and how do we know it?
So the punchline to that question is we've learned that, yes, Mars not only had liquid water, it also had environments that would have been habitable. So Mars once had environments that would have been conducive to life. This is what Curiosity has shown us. We've seen a couple things that really strongly point to it. First, what we found when we landed, even in the floor of Gale Crater, were evidence for lake deposits and evidence for stream deposits. And when we got to the base of the mountain, we saw even more evidence for lakes that had probably pooled in the bottom of the crater. And as we've been driving up and up and up and up, we're still seeing evidence for this lake. And we've seen so much of the mountain, at least the lower part of it, is formed by these ancient lake beds. It tells us the lake was not only there, but it must have been around for at least a million, probably more likely tens of millions of years. So there was liquid water, and it was there for a very long time. We can also see that this water was probably very nice water in terms of its pH. You know, it's something, the kind of water that would come out of your tap. It's not battery acid or something real nasty. It's nice neutral water. And then we also, a really big exciting discovery, found within these ancient lake beds the presence of organic molecules. So these are, you know, fancy term to basically say molecules that contain carbon. We don't know where these molecules came from. They could be evidence of past Martian life, but they could equally easily be evidence of past processes that don't need life. We find similar molecules in comets. They could have been delivered to the surface by comets. They could have come from deep in the mantle. But what their presence does tell us is that the building blocks of life were there. So we have an environment where life could have lived, and we have an environment where the building blocks of life were present.
And how much longer do we expect Curiosity to be realistically functioning on Mars?
Oh, I don't actually know the answer to that question. I hope it's a very long time. Assuming nothing goes catastrophically wrong, which, you know, you're on Mars, you never know what's going to happen. But assuming everything keeps working, the limiting factor will probably be our power source. We're powered by a radioisotope source. Basically, it's the radioactive decay charges our battery of a piece of plutonium. And so over time, that source is going to get weaker and weaker and weaker. But we have many good years left in us. All of the instruments are still working at their full capacity. So in terms of the science we're doing, we really haven't slowed down in the last 7 years. So hopefully we got another 7 good years in us, if not more.
Wow. And what are some of like the big exploration goals, you know, for you guys moving forward, like say in the next year? What are the plans moving forward for Curiosity?
Yeah, so we just finished up exploring a specific layer in the mountain that we saw from orbit was associated with clay minerals, which are particularly good minerals for trapping organic molecules. And so we're kind of looking at that data, figuring out what's going on there. And then as we drive ahead, we're at a really exciting point where we might be getting into an environmental transition. We're getting into layers that from orbit look very different, potentially much younger, potentially indicative of a completely different geologic environment. And so we're going to continue to climb up, climb kind of through time on Mars and look and see, you know, at some point the lake had to have disappeared because it's not there today. So we're going to find evidence of when that happened, what happened when that happened, and kind of what environments occurred after our lake disappeared.
You are listening to Blue Dot. I'm Dave Schlom, and we're going to take a short break, but stay with us. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Mars Curiosity Rover's Deputy Project Scientist, Abby Freeman, as we look at the current and future exploration of Mars. And we're back. Let's continue now with our interview with Abby Freeman. She's the deputy project scientist for the Curiosity rover, which is currently exploring Gale Crater on Mars. One of my favorite things about Curiosity is for anybody who's curious about this mission, appropriately, you can follow along. You can watch the rover moving. There's lots of virtual ways you can experience what Curiosity does on the JPL website. And I love the images, the beautiful images of the Mars landscape. You know, it feels like you're there. And one of my favorite things is when you take selfies of Curiosity. Could you tell us how do you go about taking a selfie?
Yes, Curiosity. We've taken selfies to Mars. So essentially, we have instrument on the end of the rover's arm, whose primary purpose is actually to act as a microscope or a hand lens and get up really close to rocks and soils and give us information about their textures. But we can also go ahead and take the arm and turn it around and point it back at ourselves. And it's such a good camera that we get these spectacular color pictures of ourselves. And so usually when there's something momentous that we do, either we drill a hole into the rock or we're at a particularly good viewpoint, we'll turn around and we'll take some pictures of ourselves and make this beautiful selfie image. I think they're great too, because you know, you can see the rover, but you also see the landscapes of Mars in the background. And one of the things about Gale Crater and Mount Sharp that's just so spectacular is how alien but also familiar at the same time it looks. You know, standing on the flanks of this mountain, looking out to the rim of this impact crater, you might as well be in Death Valley, kind of looking out into the mountains in the distance. It's really remarkable.
Yeah, and yet, like you said, at the same time, it is very Mars-ish looking. It has that look where you know this is not on Earth, you're on Mars. And I'd like to ask you about that for you personally, and for your colleagues. It must really be like when you go to work that you're in a very real way, virtually going to Mars. And I'm wondering if you could tell us about what that experience is like to be, you know, in a sense, working on another planet through this robotic rover.
Oh my gosh, it is the coolest thing. I love my job. And I love that, you know, first thing every morning I come in and I look at the latest downlink from the rover and I see the images that we'd plan to take, or I see the new vista after our most recent drive, and I just get to stare at it and I get to think about it, and I get to think about, what am I looking at? What does this mean in terms of the history of Mars? And then the really fun part is, okay, well, what do we want to do next? You know, we plan what we want to do with the rover almost every day. And so it's every day we have to think about how do we want to use the resources we have available for this day to do the best science, the most efficiently, and explore the most.
Yeah. And I bet for you and your colleagues, you know, when you see those images, you know, it has to dawn on you that you're the first person or people at that time you see the images. It's the first time anyone's ever seen that particular view ever.
Yeah, no, it's awesome. But I will say all of our images, we see them, but we post them online for anybody in the world to see real time. So anyone anywhere can go, and if you just, you know, search for Curiosity Raw Images, you can find the webpage where, as we see the images downlink, you can see them too. So, you know, I love being able to see this, but I also love that we can share this with the world. It's not just the scientists who get to go on this journey. It's hopefully everybody who's interested.
Yeah, and the images are striking and beautiful. Another aspect of working on Mars virtually, like you do, has to do with Mars' rotation rate, which is just slightly different from Earth's. And so, you know, you call a day on Mars a sol, you know, named after the sun. So a day is a sol on Mars. And I know you've been on Mars for many sols now through all of your explorations with the different rovers. Could you explain to us what it's like, how that time shift changes when you go to work and when you do things for a lot of you?
Yeah, so we call it Mars time. And it matters because we plan the rover day by day. So the rover will do whatever we want it to do for that day, and then it sends back at the end of the day everything it's done. And then we'll stay up all of the Martian night planning what we want to do the next day, and then you repeat that. Now, if you realize the Martian day is, you know, close to 25 hours long, that means that the start of the Martian night shifts by an hour every day. So one day you might supposed to start at 9, and then the next day at 10, and then the next day at 11, and the next day at 12. And so you're kind of traveling a single time zone every day. When Curiosity first landed, and also when Spirit and Opportunity first landed, we all lived on Mars time, which was this essentially 25-hour day for about 3 months. And for me, it was really fun. I was a graduate student at the time. I didn't really have any responsibilities. So it was great getting to sleep in and go into work later and later. But it's not really a sustainable thing to do, especially, you know, you need your life, and it's hard when you don't have a set schedule. So after 3 months, we transition more towards Earth time, where when we have days where the calendars don't quite line up, what we'll do is we'll plan 2 days at a time instead of one. So this way we can keep kind of normal, we'll say 7 a.m. to 8 or 9 p.m. hours as we shift through this cycle. There are some people, though, who do stay on Mars time for all of their career, and those are the people who do the uplink and the downlink to the rover. So they are always on Mars time because they need to be commanding it in real time.
Wow. Yeah, that must be interesting and difficult in some ways, because your whole life has to change and your family and everything has to kind of wrap around that Mars time schedule.
Yeah, it's a weird perspective, you know, going into work at 11 p.m. and then finishing at around 8 a.m. and then having your end of the day barbecue. we did that a few times on Mars time. It was fun for the first couple months, but it got old.
Yeah, I imagine. Well, now that we have the new rover about to head to Mars, Mars 2020, which hasn't been named yet, but will be, I hear, soon, I'm wondering, what are some of the big questions that Curiosity has developed that Mars 2020 will be trying to answer? So kind of passing the baton to the next rover or working together, what are some of the things that Curiosity has done that will shape the mission for Mars 2020?
Absolutely. And as you say, kind of each rover we send builds on the discoveries of the previous one. So the big discovery from Curiosity was that Mars had habitable environments. So the next question, and it's really the question we want to answer, is Mars is, was there ever life on Mars? We know all the ingredients were there. So did it arise? Now, unfortunately, making the leap from finding that there were environments to supporting life to actually finding evidence of life itself is really hard. And we don't quite know how to put the instrumentation that we need to answer that question onto a rover. So instead, we're sending a rover that's going to send the samples back to us. So the goal of the Mars 2020 rover mission, the main goal is going to be to explore this site. It's called Jezero Crater. It's another site where we think there was probably a lake that would have been a great place to concentrate life. So explore this crater and use its suite of instruments to document the context of the samples, and then collect these little kind of chalk size pieces of rock and put them in these very special hermetically sealed tubes that it's going to deposit along the way, that we could potentially in the future go and pick up with a future mission and bring back to Earth to basically throw the full weight of our analytical capabilities at really well-characterized Martian samples to really try and answer that question, was there life on Mars?
And, you know, answer this if you'd like to or not. It's hard to ask a scientist like yourself to speculate, and because you can only go with the data and what the evidence is telling you. But what's your gut feeling? Do you think that life was once on Mars and perhaps still is subsurface or whatever? What's your feeling at this point after all you've seen through these years?
Yeah, I'm going to give you a really unsatisfying answer and say, I don't know. And that's why I love being part of these missions, because it's really looking and exploring. And, you know, I think the place where we're sending the next rover, if there was life on Mars, that's a really good place to look. It's not the only really good place to look. As you mentioned, subsurface areas might be great places to look, other places. Certainly, whatever we find with the samples is going to change our knowledge of Mars. It's going to be a huge step forward. And I'm just excited to learn whatever it is we have to learn. I really don't know the answer.
Well, for me personally, I find that to be a very satisfactory answer and the kind of answer that you should give.
Good.
But maybe I'll turn the question a little bit and say, from everything that we've observed, it seems like to me that nothing has shut off that possibility.
That's right. We haven't seen anything so far that's been a showstopper. As I said, with Curiosity and building on the shoulders of Spirit and Opportunity and our fleet of orbiters and we've learned everything was there, we think. You know, we still don't know exactly how life began. So we don't know, was that secret life-beginning mechanism present on Mars? But there's certainly nothing there that would preclude life from having been there or there today.
And for people who are listening to this program or perhaps hear about the exploration of Mars and wonder why we do this, you know, we have a planet here that we need desperately to take care of. I'm wondering if you could explain to us why you think it's important to explore Mars.
I think there's a couple of reasons. First, I think answering this life question is one of the greatest questions that we as a species could try to answer. Because if we find evidence for life on Mars, you know, that's such a profound statement that life has arisen independently at least two places in our solar system. And given our knowledge of solar systems everywhere, you know, we're finding thousands of planets around other stars. I think that tells us a lot about our place in the universe. Even if we don't find life on Mars, I think it's a really awesome place to study because it is a very unique planet. Mars, most of its crust is very, very old, older than 3 billion years, which is something that we don't have on Earth anymore. Plate tectonics has destroyed it. So it has this very unique record of what planets are like in the first 1 billion, 2 billion years of their formation. And that's all really interesting information as well to just understand how planets work. And again, in thinking about these thousands of planets that we're finding, you know, how do they work? How come, what would govern some of them to maybe support life and some of them not to? I think that's another amazing question that we can answer with Mars. You know, you brought up our own planet, and it's a very special planet, and I agree. And I'll just put a plug for my own opinion. I don't think studying Mars as a place to terraform and turn into a second Earth when we trash our first planet, I don't think that is a good thing to be saying. I think the planet we have right now is spectacular, and it's going to be a lot harder to turn Mars into Earth than it will be to fix the problems we have here on Earth. So I'm a proponent of staying where we are and fixing what we've done rather than thinking about expanding out into the solar system and trashing the home we have.
Yeah, I agree with you there. And just perhaps that the, you know, understanding why Mars is not a habitable place today like the Earth is with water and its climate has changed so drastically. It's kind of a cautionary tale that planets are precious and fragile places.
Absolutely. And you know, studying Mars and helping understand the mechanisms that really drove that change is, I think, a really exciting question.
Well, Abby Freeman, it's been a joy to talk to you about your interest in Mars and your role as Deputy Project Scientist for the Curiosity rover. And thank you for spending the time with us and putting this into perspective for us as we get ready for the next chapter in the exploration of Mars with the new rover 2020, while we, you know, should make sure we add that Curiosity will keep rolling on.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for letting me talk about the work that I love to do.
Thanks to Curiosity rover Deputy Project Scientist Abby Freeman. After a short break, we'll look forward to the new rover mission to Mars, Mars 2020, with JPL's Ken Williford. And we're back, and thanks for listening. Our next guest is one of our favorite veteran guests on Blue Dot, Ken Williford. He's one of the deputy project scientists for the new rover going to Mars, Mars 2020, that doesn't have a name yet, does it, Ken?
It does not, but we're getting close.
Yeah. Can you maybe, before we go any further, tell us about the process of how you go about naming a rover?
Yeah, I don't know how much detail just that I can actually remember about the process, but it's a pretty involved process. And the general thing that most people would be interested to know is that ultimately it'll be named by a U.S. school kid, anywhere from kindergarten through high school age, I believe. And so where the process now is it's around, they've released 155 out of something like over 20,000 name and essay entries. And it's boiled down to 155, and I believe we've gotten it down to 9 from there, which will soon be released. And then I believe there's going to be a big public vote, and that'll be part of what's taken into consideration. And ultimately, NASA headquarters will announce the final name.
Cool. And when do you think we'll have that? Is that like this spring?
I believe it'll be sometime in the spring. I'm guessing, March-ish timeframe.
Yeah, well, curiosity needs a sibling with a name.
Indeed.
Well, let's talk about this new mission. Before we talk about the rover itself and its capabilities, tell us about the actual mission itself. Whereas Curiosity has been roving around Gale Crater looking for evidence that there were the environments that were suitable for life, what is the exact mission statement, if you will, for the new rover 2020?
Yeah, that's right. So we really follow right on the heels of Curiosity most recently, as you said, which has a mission that's still going really well to understand the habitability of various environments in Gale Crater. But really, our lineage, in a sense, goes all the way back to Viking, which was, decades ago, had a mission to look for signs of life on the surface of Mars, as do we. So one of our taglines is seeking the signs of life. There's a big difference, though, between Viking and us. And Viking was looking for signs of what we call extant life, that is, life that's currently alive or recently dead, whereas our mission, the field of astrobiology has evolved since Viking, and we now think, the surface of Mars is so inhospitable, it would be very difficult for any life as we know it to survive there currently. But we believe Mars, deep in its past, several billion years ago, would have been much more Earth-like and able to support life. And so our job is to look for signs of ancient life, and that's really one of a few objectives, science objectives that we have.
So, but to follow up on that, So you're kind of, in a way, you're looking for what, fossils of ancient life, of microbial fossils? Would that be fair to say?
That's exactly right. The fossils, as most people think of them, I'd gather most people think of dinosaur bone, when they think of fossils. And so fossils can be of the organism itself, sort of the preserved remains of the body of an ancient organism. But they can also be, more broadly interpreted as signs of life, fossil signs of life, so the traces of life, not necessarily the bodies themselves, but the impacts they leave behind on the environment, their waste products, the way they have changed the chemistry of their environment, and then that chemistry has been locked into a crystal that we could then later analyze and read the chemical change in that environment and interpret it as potentially having been caused by a living organism. So that's another type of fossil, in a sense. We call those things, broadly speaking, biosignatures. So that's any sign of ancient life. And so we're looking for the signs of life, either the fossil bodies, as you said, or their impacts on their environment.
And if there is something actually alive now in the region you're going to be studying, you'd be able to find that too, right?
Well, there are certain organisms that you could imagine perhaps fancifully. We really don't, those of us who study the possibility of life outside Earth think it's extremely unlikely that life as we know it could survive in any appreciable way right at the surface in the environments that we'll be looking at. You know, potentially in the deep subsurface maybe, but those environments are really inaccessible to us right now with our rover. And so the rocks we're looking at were deposited billions of years ago in an environment that we think was very habitable and very, you know, had a lot of capacity to support life as we know it today. But we would be looking at its ancient record.
Yeah. So, okay, fair enough. If there is something, microbial organisms living on Mars today, they have to be shielded from the radiation. They have to be well below the surface where you will be able to examine.
Yeah, of course, I'm never going to say it's impossible, you know, but it is certainly not our mission or our intent. We haven't designed the mission in any way, really, to look for signs of extant life, things today living today. We've really focused on the best possible set of capabilities that we can send to Mars to look for signs of ancient life. And in some way, those are different capabilities.
Well, let's talk about the rover itself, because, you know, it's this next generation, very exciting. I'd like you to give us kind of an overview, maybe start from the bow to the stern, if you will, from the front to the back. Tell us about some of the capabilities of this rover and how it compares to Curiosity.
Right. Well, if you were walking toward the bow of our rover, as you said, walking up to greet our rover, the first thing that you would encounter would be the robotic arm and the turret. And like the Curiosity rover, we have a robotic arm and a turret that is a rotating assembly out at the end of the robotic arm that has a sort of toolkit. So you can think of this as like a giant Swiss Army knife of, you know, generally much more complicated tools, of course, than you'd find on a Swiss Army knife, but it's a similar concept. And in fact, our robotic arm, like most of our rover, will look almost indistinguishable to Curiosity. So people seeing images of our rover, it should look very familiar to those of them who are, you know, fans of the MSL mission and familiar with Curiosity. Because we've used as much as we possibly could, we've used as much of the designs that were successful for MSL to build this rover. And then we've packed a new set of instruments onto the rover. And the big new advance for us is the sampling system, the drill, and the internal mechanisms inside the front of the rover that process sampling. And this is all in service of one of our key objectives, maybe you could say our key objective, which is to select and collect samples that could one day be returned by other missions to Earth for analysis in Earth-based laboratories. So the first thing you'd see would be that drill and a set of instruments out on the turret.
As we go through the rover's capabilities, one of my favorite things about all of the rovers, from, you know, Pathfinder and Sojourner on through the Spirit and Opportunity and Curiosity now, is the wonderful pictures that they send us that make you feel like you're really on the surface of Mars. Tell us about the camera capabilities of this rover compared to Curiosity.
Well, there are, I believe, 23 cameras on this rover. So all of the Mars rovers have had multiple cameras. But we have a set of engineering cameras, which are, you know, offer the basic capability of the rover to both drive, to take pictures that rover planners back on Earth can use to plan a drive through the terrain. But also when the rover, you know, gets over the next hill that you see in the image and you could no longer see the terrain that's in the image, the rover can continue to drive autonomously. So it can use its cameras to detect obstacles in front of it. Think rocks, you know, cobbles and small boulders, that sort of thing, or, you know, a small cliff or something like that. If something like that shows up in the picture, the rover is kind of constantly, when it's doing this autonomous navigation, generating a 3D model of its environment in front of it. If it sees an obstacle, it makes a turn and it drives around those obstacles, and it can keep doing that for a while until it, you know, uses up the amount of energy that we'd like to allow it to use for that sol. So it's very exciting. We have a new set of engineering cameras. We call the enhanced engineering cameras, or the double E-cams, as distinct from the MSL and MER E-cams. And for now, for the first time on a Mars rover, the engineering cameras will be in color. So the previous engineering cameras have been black and white. Now we have these beautiful 20 megapixel cameras that are capable of taking high resolution color. So that's very exciting. The other extremely exciting new cameras that we have are the entry, descent, and landing, or EDL, cameras. And these are like a small camera. It's like a GoPro. It's not actually a GoPro, but imagine that. And imagine one of those on the descent stage looking down at the rover as it does the sky crane maneuver, if you're familiar with that. It's going to be taking video, high-res video, of the rover lowering itself down onto the surface of Mars. There'll be another one of those on the rover looking up at the descent stage, and another one on top of the spacecraft as the parachute opens and inflates, and we'll take high-res video of the parachute. So all that is going to take a while to get down over our deep space network, but some months into the mission, you should expect to see some really spectacular images and video of the landing process on this mission.
Wow. So, you know, whereas we got to see simulations of what that was like for Curiosity with the amazing sky crane where they lower the rover below that tether and then kind of cut the tether and fly away, and then it fires the rockets and gently lands. We'll get to see that, what that looked like from that point of view. That's amazing.
Yes, it should be very amazing and obviously spectacular and just interesting to look at, but also very important to the engineering and science, really, of the processes of a parachute opening in the atmosphere of Mars. You know, that's not something that's ever been recorded in that way, visualized in that way. And what we have to rely on are models that are informed by tests done in the Earth atmosphere, but you can only test with a certain level of fidelity. It's a very hard test to run because the gravity at Mars is different, the atmospheric pressure is very different, and so really having that video to go along with the other rover data that we bring down about the entry, descent, and landing process is a really precious resource to future Mars exploration as well.
Yeah, I can see where you can get lots of wonderful science and engineering information from that. That's very exciting. I didn't know about that. Okay, let's talk about some of the other new capabilities. One of the things I saw that I found very interesting is you've learned a lot from roving around in Gale Crater with Curiosity about how the wheels hold up and get, or don't, getting punctured by rocks and stuff. Tell us about the new wheels.
That's right. That was one of the, in a sense, unexpected results of MSL. As you said, the team noticed that the wheels were degrading faster than expected. The engineers always expected them to degrade. They're designed to live for quite a long time, even once they're getting ripped up by rocks, sharp rocks on Mars. But that process was happening faster than people had predicted, and it has to do with how tests were run and so forth. So we learned that lesson at JPL, and a lot of work very early on was done to design a new set of wheels to just completely avoid that problem. At JPL, they talk about certain problems that you just kill. You know, you throw everything at it, and it's not like, if we make it a bit better, we can, improve it a bit. It's like, this is just eliminate it. And so they've really designed a great new set of wheels that fit within our mass limits, because you're always worried about mass and volume on space missions like this. So you don't have infinite room to make things beefier and stronger. But they put a lot of smart design work into it. And I've seen the wheels personally after they've run three times their design life, where they're designed to travel 20 kilometers. So you test them for 60 kilometers over very rough terrain. And they basically they're a bit scratched up, but otherwise brand new, so these are really strong, excellent wheels that we have for the Mars 2020 rover.
And at JPL, you have like actual, like this simulated sandbox with rocks and stuff to simulate the surface. Is that where they do that testing, or do they go out somewhere else to the desert to do that? Where do they test that?
Yeah, there is. You're talking about the Mars Yard, I think. So that's one of the very special parts of JPL is this sandbox, as you said, and there's rocks in there and slopes, and the team can create different terrain types and test mobility systems on them. A lot of the testing is done there, absolutely. Some of it is done, like you say, out in remote environments, not at JPL, where you take not the actual rover, of course, but an engineering model of the mobility system. And for a lot of those tests, you want to design the thing so it behaves as if it's in Mars gravity, so it needs to be lower mass. We call it the scarecrow. It's just the mobility system and limited rover body. But take that thing out to the dunes or, you know, other steep terrain that you think you might want to test on that you can't simulate at the Mars Yard. So some of it's done there, and then some of it's done inside in laboratories where you set up imagine a ring with a bunch of rocks in it, and then you have one arm in the middle that just cycles around the ring, and you can put a set of wheels on that and just roll them over, you know, and just keep running it day and night until the wheels have roved the equivalent of 60 kilometers. And so that's one way the tests are done.
Yeah, that's just amazing, the engineering prowess of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and the people that work there. What a wonderful job to think. It's like, I have to design something to explore an alien world and make it last. And so far, you've been tremendously successful. One of the things you mentioned earlier, and for those of you keeping score at home, MSL is the Mars Science Laboratory, aka Curiosity, the big rover that's there now in Gale Crater, and MER is the Mars Exploration Rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, that are no longer functioning, but still up there. I'm really interested in this concept that you talked about of preparing samples to someday bring them back to study them here on Earth. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. That concept that you're talking about is Mars sample return. And this is something that people in the space science and engineering community have wanted to do for a very long time. In fact, I'm told the conversation started up not long after Apollo, thinking about what's the next big thing we could do. And the Apollo astronauts, of course, brought back lots of moon rocks, and the analysis of those moon rocks on Earth really revolutionized our understanding of our place in the solar system and in the universe broadly. And so it was thought, well, what if we could extend that to another planet? And the natural other place to do that is Mars. Of course, you could go to Jupiter, but it's sort of harder to get back, and it's harder to exist on Jupiter because it's very, very hot. But Mars, you can imagine it, but this has been a concept that has evolved over decades, and people even joke about it, all the different attempts over the years we thought we were about to do Mars sample return, and then it gets canceled because it's an expensive proposition that requires attention, political, economic, and, technical attention over many, many years, longer than most space development missions. And so, but here we are. We are absolutely closer than we've ever been to Mars sample return, and it's a core part of Mars 2020's mission is to collect samples that we select for their potential to preserve signs of ancient life or signs of ancient, planetary evolution. We want to understand whether or not Mars hosted life, how did it evolve as a planetary system, and what can it tell us broadly about the universe and even our own planet's evolution. And so we'll select areas in our environment that we believe are most likely to preserve those things in the rocks, and we'll core them with our coring drill. And inside the drill bit is a titanium tube. We actually have 40-some titanium tubes stored in the body of the rover, and there's a device that inserts an empty sample tube into a drill bit, which then gets chucked into the drill. That drill is out at the end of the robotic arm. You drill into a rock. The rock goes inside the tube. The drill bit with the tube inside goes back into the body of the rover, and it's processed. Someone recently described this as like a Coke bottling plant. Imagine a little robotic bottle manipulator inside the rover. There's a little robotic arm doing that, and it seals it up. First takes a picture of it, analyzes its volume, seals it up, stores it for a while until we find a safe location. And then we'll drop these samples, these filled titanium sample tubes, on the surface of Mars, and another set of missions that are currently envisioned. And there's a formal statement of an intent to cooperate between NASA and the European Space Agency, ESA, on this campaign of missions. Neither of the follow-on missions are formally funded yet, but there are people working on developing the concepts and starting to work together to think about how do we really get these samples home that Mars 2020 will collect.
Well, we're about out of time, but a couple of quick questions. When is launch kind of currently scheduled for?
Our launch window opens July 17th of this year, and it's at Cape Canaveral. There will be an Atlas V rocket, like the MSL mission, standing up there at Cape Canaveral, and we'll all converge for a team meeting a few days before that, and then excitedly wait for the launch to happen. We hope on the 17th, but if not that day, you know, some day soon after.
Before we let you go, I have to ask you one last question. Do you fantasize or ever think about, you know, this could be it, this, well, the moment that happens where you finally at some point in the future, because of this mission, it does detect a definitive sign that there was life on Mars? Do you ever fantasize about that?
It's interesting. I have spent so many years of my life really dedicated to that end, not specifically to looking for life on Mars, but trying to understand, you know, the basic nature of life on Earth and ask the question, was there life ever beyond Earth? And right now I have my head down, like a lot of people on the team, just doing the work we need to do to be ready to take advantage of this incredible opportunity that we have. You know, it will be, no matter what we find, I think, just the opportunity to be on another world there. But certainly if we find evidence of ancient life, it's just, yeah, it's a dream scientifically.
Yeah, well, I want to thank you for spending the time with us to tell us about Mars 2020 and wish you all and, you know, the entire team the best of luck with the new rover. And I look forward to finding out its name this spring and having you back on after launch.
Absolutely. Thank you. It was great to talk to you.
Thanks to our guests, Abby Freeman, Deputy Project Scientist for the Curiosity rover, and Ken Williford, who is the DPS for the upcoming Mars 2020 rover set to launch this summer. And this just in, you have until January 27th to vote on naming the rover. The public poll will play a factor in naming the Mars 2020 machine that will roll around in Jezero Crater. Here are the 9 finalists from the K-12 students around the country. The names are Endurance, Tenacity, Promise, Perseverance, Vision, Clarity, Ingenuity, Fortitude, and Courage. I think they're all great names, and I'm trying to figure out which one I'm going to vote for. Blue Dot is a production of North State Public Radio in beautiful and talented Northern California. You can revisit this and past episodes you missed at mynspr.org, or better yet, subscribe to our podcast on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcast groove on. We are distributed by the Public Radio Exchange, better known as PRX. Our theme music is by Matt Schultz. Blue Dot is engineered and produced by the maestro, Mr. Matt Fidler. Our associate producer and owner of a dog named Rocket is Ellie Johnson. For all of us here, I remind you there that from deep space, we all live on a pale blue dot.